in the matter of DCPP versus EMC and the guardianship of AEC. May we please have appearances? Good morning, Council. Happy New Year. Welcome. Ms. Licata.
Justice Rabner, Justices, good morning. May I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Of course.
Thank you. This case is about an overlooked father. As the dissenting appellate division judge found, the parental rights of EMC were terminated when he was not considered for placement of his child, even though he had successfully cared for him for 18 months.
Could you please keep your voice up?
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure. He was not served with the preliminary Title 30 and guardianship complaints, even though the division had actual notice of where he was living. He was not permitted to see his son unless visits were supervised, even though no judge ever determined that supervision was necessary to protect AEC. He was ordered to submit to a psychological evaluation that was neither necessary for reunification or helpful in determining his ability to care for his son. Due process does not permit the state to overlook fathers. It's bedrock constitutional law that when the state seeks to terminate a parental relationship, it must provide parents with fundamentally fair procedures. The procedures employed here were not fundamentally fair and did not protect EMC's presumptive right as a fit biological parent to the custody of his child and to the maintenance of a parental relationship. Instead, the procedures here were rooted in the state's misconduct. And that misconduct is mind-boggling. DCPP claimed it could not find EMC to serve him with the complaints at issue here in 2014 and 2015. But during 2014, a different division office was conducting an investigation because of allegations that EMC's fiancé, N.R., was not sending her children to school. Workers from that office interviewed EMC, N.R., EMC's mother, and EMC's sister, and also vouched to the local school district that the family lived at 49 Schuyler Terrace. The workers entered that contact information into New Jersey Spirit, DCPP's database, where it was accessible by parent name, child name, relative name, participant names, and Spirit ID. If someone searched by name, all cases associated with that person would be found, and all offices and investigations would be found. Each of the workers here, in this case, the permanency worker, the adoption worker, and the paralegal specialist, was aware that such a search was possible, but none of them chose to undertake that search. This was a knowing decision, and each person pointed the finger at the other as her responsibility. At a remand ordered by this court, the division worker in the guardianship matter testified that EMC was not intentionally left out. He was overlooked. And the worker used the word overlooked in mitigation as if to say that this was not that bad. But it was bad, and it was misconduct. Failing to use the agency's own database to find EMC set the stage for this entire litigation, resulting in EMC not being considered as a placement for his son, and in attempting to squeeze the 2 years of litigation the division had with the mother, ASK, into a 3-month period for EMC. EMC missed appointments in the guardianship litigation, and he missed appointments due to life circumstances ranging from the tragic to the ordinary, because of a house fire and because of hospitalizations of other children, and because of conflicts between employment, childcare, and transportation issues. These missed appointments were not failures to attend treatment. They were not failures to attend substance abuse treatment or mental health treatment. They were failures to keep an appointment for a required psychological evaluation for a parent with no history of mental health or substance abuse issues. There were appointments for supervised visitations for a parent that conflicted with EMC's employment obligations and for which supervision was never determined to be necessary to protect AEC. The division's conduct in this case typifies the systemic problems found by the Federal Department of Children and Families and noted in its 2017 report for New Jersey. New Jersey needs improvement and is not in substantial conformity with two important outcomes: engaging parents, in particular fathers, and in tailoring services to the needs of families. DCF specifically found an over-reliance on psychological evaluations to drive service planning, and that such evaluations typically are requested for all families, whether the parents' needs warrant it or not. The final result of termination of parental rights because of missed appointments cannot be sustained, as it is neither in the best interest of this child, nor can it be said to comport with any semblance of due process. The actions of DCPP employees in failing to use a database at their disposal to locate missing parents is arbitrary conduct that violates principles of fundamental fairness. The judgment terminating parental rights must be reversed and the matter remanded to the trial court to determine appropriate procedures to reunify AEC with EMC.
You've highlighted problematic conduct that we will ask the state to explain and account for when we get to that part of the argument. I'd like you to focus on what happened in the proceedings here, though, and tell us the impact of that argument. February 19th, 2015, the complaint is filed. EMC is not served until nearly a year later, January 11th, 2016. What happens in the intervening months of substance as relates to EMC? There were five case management conferences. What else took place of substance in that period of time?
Justice Rabner, are you referring to in EMC's life or in the litigation?
In the litigation.
There were case management conferences resulting in orders, again, for the psychological evaluation, for supervised visitation. As to the mother.
Okay.
Nothing was happening with respect to EMC except no search was ordered during that 2015 year. The search was not ordered again until it was requested by the DAG, and it occurred in the beginning of 2016. And that's when the paralegal specialist apparently utilized New Jersey Spirit and was able to find EMC.
I understand that. Let me ask it slightly differently then. Suppose on January 11th, 2016, the division had refiled as relates to EMC. What would have unfolded differently in litigation from that point forward?
If it was a new complaint, then EMC should have been given appropriate time in order to comply with whatever services were deemed to be necessary. And respectfully, the trial judge should have determined whether a psychological evaluation was necessary or not.
So this trial begins in June.
Correct.
Does EMC ask for more time?
His counsel repeatedly asked for adjournments when he was unable to make the appointments for the psychological evaluation, and he was granted some.
Did, at the time that the trial was slated to proceed, did EMC object and ask for an adjournment?
On that morning, yes. That morning, what was supposed to happen that morning was, at the proceeding before, the trial judge had said, we're going to schedule Dr. Singer's evaluation the morning of June 10th. And EMC will attend, and if he attends and there's an evaluation, then we start trial. If he doesn't attend and there's no evaluation, we're still going to start trial. And his counsel had requested an adjournment because he could not make the appointment that morning because he had a conflicting appointment with the Section 8 Housing Administrator.
I thought that appointment was at 10:30 and the judge was asking your client to show up at 9 o'clock, maybe start the evaluation, and then it could be continued at a later time. But he did not.
Justice Lavecchia, the worker, the record indicates that the worker told EMC to be there at 9. I don't believe the record indicates that start the evaluation, then go to your appointment, and then come back. I'm not aware that was an option. Okay. It was start the evaluation, and, you know, if you miss the appointment, unstated, But if you miss the appointment, you miss the appointment. There's nothing in the record that indicates that the division worker made any offer to intercede with the Section 8 administrator for that appointment, either to get it moved back or to help out in any way.
Please clarify this if you can. The request for the adjournment was with regard to the scheduling of another date, time for the evaluation. Did EMC at any point argue to the judge through counsel, we need more time in order to prepare for this trial, outside of the scheduling issue?
No, I do not believe so.
Chief? Did counsel for your client at the time of the trial ever object to the state's desire to have a psychological evaluation?
No, the record does not indicate that counsel objected to that. But as the dissenting appellate division judge found, it's the trial judge's independent duty to determine what services are necessary.
But counsel must not have thought it was a terrible burden, I would assume, since there was preparation made and a defense psychological evaluation was performed of your client in anticipation of trial. Is that correct? So it was not viewed as that difficult a burden.
I can't speak to what was in trial counsel's mind in the decision not to object. I do know she did not object, but I respectfully still maintain that notwithstanding that, it's still the trial judge's duty to determine whether services are necessary. And the fact that defense counsel, knowing that psychological evaluations had been ordered, was attempting to proceed with defense evaluations, I don't think, minimizes that burden on the trial judge.
But if the issue had been raised, then it would have been joined. There could have been a discussion.
Mm-hmm.
The whole transferring of AEC back and forth with NR not wanting him and all of that may have lent itself to having a psychological evaluation. At least if it had been raised, there would have been a discussion on the subject. So how can you claim error now with nothing in the record to suggest that one was really not warranted or would not have at least been helpful, would have done no harm?
I believe that, as the federal government found it, the reliance on psychological evaluations is overused. I think the fact that...
But that's not the argument before us right now. The issues are whether there was an objection or not or whether that created an issue.
But
not whether they're abused or not. There's no evidence or any of that before this court right now.
That's true. That's not in this record. But this is a report the court could take judicial notice of. But to address more specifically Justice Alvin's question, the fact that back in 2013, during the months that EMC did have AEC, that there was conflict between his fiancée, NR, and the question of whether he had fathered another child with ASK, that's something that has occurred previously in other cases. It's something that occurred that this court addressed in the CM case, where the father did not immediately step forward to take custody of his 8-month-old son because of the impact it had on his marriage. That's not something that necessarily raises, to my mind, the need for psychological...
There's something a little bit different here. Because when he took custody of the child in March of 2012, the child was malnourished, underdeveloped, which indicated that the mother had been neglecting the child. So when he turned the child back to the person who had clearly been neglecting the child, it's not a question of not arranging something else where the child is otherwise in a safe environment. Arguably, he was returning the child back to a potentially dangerous environment.
When the child went back to ASK, the child was in good physical condition and up to date on everything.
Mm-hmm.
It should be remembered that DCPP, when it became involved with ASK, never filed a Title IX abuse or neglect complaint. It always filed under Title 30. And the reason that ultimately AEC was removed from ASK was not because of any issues in relation to AEC's own health or the condition of the house or anything like that. It related to her marijuana use.
I know, but I'm just pointing out a fact. When he took the child, and he did the right thing, he took the child to a pediatrician. The pediatrician was alarmed at the child's condition, correct?
The pediatrician contacted the division because the child hadn't been there in a couple of months. Mm-hmm. He hadn't seen the child in a while.
When your client met Miss Benjamin outside, I'll call her A's house, in 2014, does he contest that he was aware at the time he had that encounter that the child was in a resource placement?
He knew the child was with SK, which was A's maternal cousin. He knew that because the record indicates...
So he contests that he did not know that that was a resource placement?
He did not know that there was that litigation had been filed. He was never served with anything. He was never advised that he had a right to counsel. He never knew that this was a situation that could turn into termination of parental rights.
Step back before you get to that point. As a result of that conversation, should the court make anything of the fact that during that encounter, knowing that the child was not with A anymore, was with someone, I thought he understood a resource placement, he did not offer himself as a placement at that point in time in that exchange with Ms. Benjamin.
I don't believe that that's something that the court can make any issue out of. SK was a maternal cousin to, again, and I don't want to, I have to go back to the issue of what he knew about the litigation. If he didn't know about the litigation in his mind, the child's with a family member. So he doesn't necessarily know it's a resource placement. He may know that the division is involved and comes to see. He may or may not know.
Well, that was
the
encounter. That was the encounter where Ms. Benjamin told him about a family conference within the next week and encouraged him strongly to attend, which he did not do. So how did the import of this situation not become something that he was aware of?
He knew there was division involvement, thanks to Ms. Benjamin. He did not attend the family conference because he had a conflict with his grandmother being hospitalized. He did not... The division can be involved, and it doesn't necessarily impress upon the point that there's danger here, there's a red flag, I might lose my child. The division becomes involved, and in this case was involved, in care and supervision.
Wasn't he told that it had to do with the permanency plan for his children? Didn't that suggest that perhaps that we'd be placed somewhere else? He was told in the meeting he couldn't attend that it was important that he remain in contact because they were going to discuss a permanency plan for his children with him. Didn't that alert him to something?
I believe what he was told was that the meeting was to plan for his children. I don't know if that alerted him.
Permanency plan for his children, not plan for his children.
I can't speak to what's in his mind, but I don't know if that, on its face, that does not alert him to the idea that he may lose his parental rights. It doesn't even alert him to the idea that there's litigation. An unsophisticated...
But your answer just seems inconsistent now with what you just told me a few moments ago. As a result of that conversation, why should the court not consider the fact that he did not offer himself as a placement or suggest himself as a placement when he's having this exchange with Ms. Benjamin about a next meeting to deal with the permanency plan for his child?
The fact that a parent does not immediately offer himself up for custody does not mean that his parental rights or parental relationship should be terminated. In EMC's mind, he knows that AEC is with SK, who is a family friend, a family member, and it just, I can't emphasize the importance of knowing when the parent should know that, does he know that this is a danger point? I'm going to lose my child. I don't know if he knows that.
So help me with this, because I want to understand his parental relationship with AEC. Maybe you can give us a brief timeline. So AEC is born in November of 2009, and in March 2012, EMC takes custody. What relationship did EMC have with his son during that period of time?
The record isn't clear. We know he was paying child support because it wasn't water. I believe there might have been some visitation. I don't recall for sure.
So the first 2.5 years of the child's life, there's little information that he, no information or little information about his relationship with his son?
There's little
and,
information.
And that isn't offered up by EMC?
There's little information in the record. It doesn't necessarily mean, and again, you have to remember what's going on at that time. What's going on at that time is he does take the child.
I understand, but I'm trying to figure out, and that's a good thing. I understand that. But I'm trying to understand the first 2.5 years of the child's life, whether he's had any relationship with the child.
Because the record doesn't indicate that he saw him every other weekend or some other indicia, it doesn't mean that he didn't have a relationship. We don't know. It's an unknown.
Okay, so why is that an unknown? Why is that an unknown in the record?
I would be speculating. I don't know. But at the time that he took custody of AEC, maybe he didn't feel it was necessary to inform the division. I don't know if he was asked, what was your relationship with the child? I know that the focus was on ASK, and it was learned that she had this child, AEC, and EMC had him, and that's why the division went to interview him at his home at that time.
Didn't the mother say something about his spotty relationship with the son? He wasn't there, or he wasn't present for the child, or am I mistaken about that?
She did say words to that effect, but he wasn't asked, when he was interviewed, he wasn't asked, where were, you know, what's your relationship with the child? And for whatever reason, he didn't offer it.
Okay, so we don't know for that, too. Then we know he takes the child for a period of about 6 months?
Or March 2012 to by October of 13, he was back with ASK. So okay. 18 months.
The child was with him for 18 months?
Yes.
And then, okay, after he returns the child to the mother, what sort of relationship is he having with the child?
We know from the record there is a check evaluation report from St. Barnabas where the worker, it's reported in the report that the worker in the intake tells them that EMC visits AEC at SK's home. And this was confirmed at the remand hearing when Ms. Benjamin testified, was asked about that and testified. So we know there was some visitation at SK's home in 2014. We know that as of about August of 2014, SK indicated she no longer could care for AEC, and at that point he went to ML. The record doesn't indicate when the precise time that EMC learned that the child was with ML. The first positive indication we have on in the guardianship record is that Ms. Moulton, the adoption worker in the guardianship litigation, testified that there had been a mediation and phone numbers had been exchanged. So, and this is about February 2016, so that's the first indication we have where EMC is learning that the child is with ML. We don't know if he knew that before then.
So was he making any what efforts was he making to to have contact with his child?
He, when he was asked by the court in 2016, in one of the early hearings that he was present at, he explained to the judge that he was given a phone number to call the lady, presumably ML. And every time he called, he didn't receive any answer to the phone call. And we know before that, as I said, that he had been visiting in 2014. So when he precisely was given the phone number, when he learned or had any idea of where ML was, is unknown. Ms. Moulton did testify that when she finally served him with the guardianship complaint in January 2016, he told her that he did not know how to contact the division.
So what responsibility does he have to make attempts to parent his child, even if the child is in a resource, with a resource family?
He was not unavailable. He was always available. He was overlooked. He was not notified of the urgency of the situation. There are
Does he have any responsibility on his own is the question.
He has a responsibility to have contact with his child, but he has to know where the child is. He doesn't know.
Does he have any responsibility knowing that that DCPP is involved with his family and with his child, and the child's in a resource home, to inquire once a month, once every 6 months, once a year? Is what is the status of this? Well, is there any level of responsibility that he has to interact with the process that he knows is ongoing?
Respectfully, Justice Patterson, that I think is shifting the burden back to EMC.
So is it your contention that he has no responsibility to be in touch with anybody?
It's not my contention that he has no responsibility to be in touch with anybody, but for purposes of the guardianship litigation and the proof of the four prongs, it was the division's burden to find him,
yep,
serve him, make him aware that he had a right to counsel so that he could participate in the litigation.
Right, no question they have that obligation. But I think we have that obligation on one side, and we have a record that, at least as I read it, indicates he had a happenstance meeting with the caseworker on one occasion and did nothing to even ask the mother of the child, ask somebody about the status of what was going on with this child.
At the time...
Is there a middle ground to that, is what I'm saying. I'm not saying he has a burden to ask, am I being served with a complaint today, or is there something I need to know about? But is there any level of inquiry that should be expected of a parent as to what is going on with their child?
I think when Ms. Benjamin found him at A.S. Case House in 2014 and gave him whatever notification she gave him, which I have to say is in conflict in the record as to what she exactly told him, because there's conflict between the contact sheet she entered contemporaneously with that encounter, there's conflict between what's in her affidavit, there's also conflict with what she testified to. So as to the family team meeting, it's mentioned in one place and not in another place. He tells her, I can't come to the family team meeting because I have a conflict with my grandmother being in the hospital. And we know from the parallel investigation that grandmother subsequently died that same year. So that supports that story of conflict. So, but after, even taking at face value everything that's in the record, we do know that Ms. Benjamin, after she saw him in 2014, whatever she said, she didn't follow up with a phone call till August 5th. She didn't afterwards say, oh, by the way, I didn't ask you for your address. What's your address? She never said, and when she couldn't serve him with the complaint at the family team meeting, she didn't immediately follow up and say, I need to serve you with the complaint.
You know, I understand. There are some things that were not done that are identified in the record. My question is it your contention that a parent can simply, knowing the child's in a resource family, knowing there are events being at least attempted to be scheduled regarding his child, that a parent can simply go for months and make no inquiry about the status of that child?
Ideally, perhaps he should have done more. Was he obligated to do so? I can't say that. Possible explanations are, we do know that we should not attempt to minimize what was going on in his life, in that he was parenting six other children, two of whom were documented in the record to have sickle cell anemia. He was trying to stay employed. For a time, he was trying to find housing. That's what the record shows. Now, that does not mean that when he finally is located and served, he steps up. He says, I want to parent my child. I'm going to parent my child. The judge specifically says, you know, you have other children. Are you going to be able to do this? He says, I want to do this. Okay, he could, if he was a parent who simply was, quote-unquote, unavailable or didn't care, he could have said literally and figuratively, I surrender. I give up, especially after the house fire. He could have said, I give up. I'm going to sign a surrender. He never did that. This is a guy who has no fitness issues. He's always employed. not always at the same place, but always employed. He is taking care of six other children. He's in a stable relationship. He says he wants his child.
Yeah, but good intentions are wonderful. Then there are five appointments to meet the psychologist. So I understand there's a problem here, there's a problem there. You know, and the trial court is attempting to move these proceedings along. Like how many missed meetings can there be before the trial court says, well, you know, we just have to, like, move along?
I think that the missed appointments, again, I don't think we can minimize the reasons for them. And I again say that the requirement of a psychological evaluation, the judge still had a duty to assess whether it was necessary.
So we've covered that, and we're 30 minutes into the argument, so I just want to ask you to focus on remedy, if you would. The passage of time only complicates these cases. Can you tell us, is the child in the same placement as 2.5 years ago at the time of trial?
I am advised that the child is still in that placement.
And that placement is with the siblings, correct?
Yes.
Okay, sorry.
What remedy do you ask for now?
I ask that the judgment of termination of parental rights be reversed and the matter remanded back to the trial court to determine the appropriate method of reunifying EMC with AEC.
Other questions?
I just have one. Is there an issue of the right of siblings to be with one another?
Yes.
That it's at least competing with your client's right?
That's something that Dr. Singer mentioned in his report, that one of the benefits of leaving AEC with ML was that he would have the contact with the siblings ND and ESK. But what was not considered is that AEC has six other siblings with EMC and half siblings with NR. And in the visitation that EMC was able to attend with AEC, AEC remembered those siblings, and his relationship, his visit with EMC was comfortable, and they interacted well together. And EMC got the other siblings on the phone, and AEC was able to speak to them. So it's not a black and white issue of there's siblings on this side with ML, and we're just going to forget everybody else. You know, EMC's parental rights should be terminated, and that's that. There was a relationship there, and if proper visitation had been permitted, don't forget, all orders for visitation were supervised, and this was for a parent that was working from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. He couldn't make those visits, and no consideration was given to arranging something in the evening. We know from the record that ML brought the children to ASK's home for visitation.
I think we have your position on this. We'll have you back for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Gregory.
May it please the court. The issue in this case is not what the division could have done or done better from a slice of time from February of 2015 through January of 2016. It is also not when or whether the division could have contacted EMC sooner. These facts alone are not determinative of the outcome, and they are not the end of the inquiry. The question for this court is whether an analysis of the entirety of the 2.5 year litigation, as well as Justice Ravner pointed out, the entirety of this family's history, provided a sufficient basis for the trial court and the appellate division majority to conclude that the division's efforts toward EMC were reasonable under the statute. The answer here is yes. In January of 2016, EMC was located and served with the guardianship complaint. At the division's request, the court postponed the trial and offered EMC additional time to reunify with his son. That additional time was 6 months, which is twice the statutory minimum under NJSA 30:4C-15.2. Over those 6 months, the division provided bus cards to EMC, offered him housing assistance, scheduled and encouraged visitation that was meant not only to increase the amount of time spent between father and child, but also to enhance the relationship between them, and scheduled EMC for a psychological evaluation designed to assess what services, if any, were necessary to reintegrate AEC and his special needs into EMC's life and household. EMC did not visit with his son. Despite that evaluation being rescheduled 6 times at EMC's request, he did not attend that evaluation. At the close of the guardianship trial, through counsel, EMC represented that he was not interested in seeking custody of his child, but simply did not want his rights terminated. Nothing in the remand record alters that representation. Considering not only these efforts, but also the unrefuted fact that EMC, as a result of the June 18, 2014 encounter, knew that his son was in the division's custody, knew that the division wanted to meet with him and plan for his child, and refused to provide the division with his address or meet with the division to inquire about or take a minimal step to care for his child, this court should affirm the trial court and majority opinion that the division proved by clear and convincing evidence all 4 prongs of NJSA 30:4C-15.1 and should free AEC for adoption by the only stable, significant, and safe connection he has known for the last 4 years.
Are you done with your opening statement?
Yes.
So the division, at least one arm of the division, knows at the end of 2014 of EMC's address. What went wrong? Why didn't he receive notice at that time, at the time of the filing of the complaint?
That answer, or that question, Justice Rabner, was answered by the division caseworker at the remand hearing. Unfortunately, it was human error. It was human oversight. The caseworker did not search, as she explained, she did not institute a new search under the FG litigation at that time because the affidavit under the protective services litigation had just been filed the same month of the guardianship proceeding.
So was it faulty training? Was it inappropriate use of the spirit system? Was this a problem beyond an isolated incident?
I think what Your Honor is asking, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is this whole issue of whether there is a systemic issue here versus an issue that took place in this case. And frankly, this record does not support appellant's contention that this is a systemic issue. The caseworker explained very credibly that based on her training, what she does when she receives a case for adoption is to open the file, read the file, and implement a search for a parent who is missing. In this case, what happened was she opened the file, reviewed the file, and saw an affidavit from the same month that she received the case. As a result of that, she did not implement that search. So the record doesn't support this contention that there's this systemic issue. Unfortunately, as the worker conceded, and as frankly the division conceded, this was an error unique to this case. Had the affidavit been filed perhaps 6 months before, she made it very clear that that is her typical procedure, is to implement a new search for the guardianship litigation.
Have any steps been taken to attempt to rectify or avoid this kind of mistake from being repeated?
Systemically, is that what Your Honor says?
In any way?
I don't think any steps needed to be taken because the caseworker was very clear that that is the procedure that's utilized by adoption workers when they receive cases. That was what she was trained to do. I believe she testified she'd been working for the division for 15 years and that in every case she opens a file and implements a search for a new parent. Unfortunately here, everything that could have gone wrong with regard to EMC did go wrong, and that was unique to this particular situation. Even had the affidavit under the protective services litigation been filed in July of 2014 when the search actually concluded, it still would not have caught the fact that he moved to the 49 Schuyler Terrace address.
Okay, but go back to that earlier point in time, which would not have caught the move because it hadn't been entered by the other part of the agency at that point in time. The affidavit also contains a statement that all relatives have been, the attempts have been made to reach them. It doesn't appear from the record that any attempt was made to reach out to E's mother.
The paternal grandmother.
The paternal mother. So how can that statement within the affidavit be something that this court should treat with value?
Should the division have contacted the paternal grandmother? Probably yes. But the failure to do so in this case is not determinative, considering the division did make other efforts to contact EMC.
But the mother, the paternal grandmother was never contacted.
The paternal grandmother was listed as residing at the Vermont Avenue address at the time of the 2012, that's 258 Vermont Avenue. The worker responded to that address in May of 2014 and was advised that EMC was not residing there. I don't recall whether there was a separate phone number provided specifically for the paternal grandmother, but at the time of the division's last contact with her, she was residing at the same address that the caseworker responded to in May of 2014. So it's not really clear from the record whether there could have been an independent attempt to contact her separate from that. And I think, frankly, that's very key, the fact that we know now as a result of the remand that EMC was still residing at the Vermont Avenue address in May of 2014. He did not move to the Schuyler Terrace address until November of the same year. Mm-hmm. The caseworker went there on May 5th of 2014. That was within 35 days of the division obtaining custody of the children. And she was advised by the person who answered the door that nobody by EMC's name resided there. And she testified at the remand hearing, which was reasonable, that after that there was no reason for her to yet again return to the address.
So what is the division's position, that the affidavit is accurate and technically compliant with the intendment of subsection B of the rule?
The division's position is that the search... The caseworker conceded at the remand that she didn't independently contact the paternal grandmother. Mm-hmm. In retrospect, reviewing the record, it's clear that the only address known for the paternal grandmother was at the Vermont Avenue address. Okay. So taken in those terms, yes, the affidavit does adequately and accurately represent that the division did what it could at the time to locate EMC.
The dissent raises concerns about the need for a psych eval and for supervised visits. Would you care to address that?
Absolutely. First, with respect to the psychological evaluation, Justice Alvin pointed out the issue of some back and forth conflict between we'll call her NR and EMC with regard to AEC remaining in EMC's care. But that's not really the only issue here. As the court has already pointed out, there was a significant passage of time. EMC last cared for AEC in arguably October of 2013. It appears the child was back and forth. By the time EMC re-entered the litigation in January of 2016, it was 2.5 years later, and AEC had been diagnosed with some very significant special needs at that point. He was receiving psychotherapy. He had at one point been medicated psychiatrically, which is quite young for a child. He also had some disruptive disorders. Under those circumstances, it is not unreasonable, and it was not unreasonable for the trial court to determine that there needed to be an evaluation to assess not just whether EMC could parent generally, but whether EMC could parent AEC specifically. Combined with the fact that, as Justice Alvin again pointed out, EMC entrusted AEC to ASK's care after being advised twice, not just in April of 2012, but also in September of 2012, that there were concerns with ASK's parenting. A's parenting, I think, is what we're referring to her as. Mm-hmm. That decision is troubling in light of the condition that the child was in at the time of the pediatrician. Appellant discusses, I think the dissent also characterized it as he was undernourished. It was more than that. He was diagnosed with failure to thrive. He had eczema that was described as black and scabby, with these scabs falling off of his body. EMC was advised not just in April of 2012, but also in September, that there were major concerns with ASK's parenting. In fact, during the September 2012 investigation, after being advised of the concerns with ASK's parenting, EMC agreed that he would only allow AEC to have supervised parenting time with ASK. Obviously, that did not happen because, as we know, sometime between July 2013 and October 2013, the child returned to the mother's care. Taking all of that into consideration, plus the fact that even the dissent recognized that based on the passage of time, some sort of bonding evaluation also needed to take place, given the fact that this child had already been in the division's custody for a substantial amount of time. The trial court's decision to order the psychological evaluation, EMC's failure to object to it, and the division's request for it were certainly reasonable under the circumstances.
How about supervised release?
Again, the supervised visitation was in recognition. First, it was not objected to also. I would like to note that at the outset, as the court has already asked. It was not objected to at all. Again, considering the fact that the dissent agreed that based on the passage of time, there needed to be some sort of an assessment of the bond between father and child, And again, based on the fact that this child at the time was approximately 5 years old, he had told an evaluator in March of 2016 that he did not know his father's name, he did not know who he was, it was entirely reasonable, again, for the court to order and the division to request that, at a minimum, the first few contacts between father and child be supervised. Had EMC complied with that visitation, there is certainly the possibility that the constraints of that visitation could eventually have been lifted. But the fact that it was not is as a result of EMC missing that visitation. I'd also like to comment on the concern of his work schedule and the schedule of the visitation, and note that EMC himself acknowledged that the division offered additional liberal visitation supervised by the resource parent, which EMC did not take advantage of. Mm-hmm. So the idea that he could not make these visits because of his work schedule is certainly not supported by the record, and the division, in fact, offered more flexible visitation for EMC, again, which he did not take advantage of.
Let me follow up on the chief's question about potential improvements, as it were. There was testimony at the remand hearing about this computer system that's used, NJ Spirit. And there seemed to be, at least I was envisioning it to look, based on the description, a little bit like medical records that are constantly, they're cumulative, essentially. The medical records remain, and the information essentially remains in the file. Additional information is added. And the sense I got from the testimony was that as a result of the way it's set up, there was some misleading information that as to the current address, based on the dates. Am I right about that?
Not necessarily. The information in New Jersey Spirit itself is accurate.
Right. But it was presented, at least as I understand what the gist of the testimony was, it was presented so that it may have given a misleading impression as to when the particular address was input and it when was, it was current.
It was when it was printed, I think.
When it was printed.
What, okay,
when
yes.
It was printed.
So
yeah.
the testimony on remand, the whole NJ Spirit issue is a little bit complicated.
I'm sorry, yeah. You keep your voice up.
I apologize, sorry. So it's not an issue of it. So the testimony established, and there really is no contest with regard to it, that when an investigation, just that particular piece of the division's record, is printed, it will reflect the current address.
Right.
And that was why there was confusion
right.
with regard to the dissent.
Right. And that's consistent with how I read what was said.
Okay.
Is there anything that can be done, or has anybody looked at, and it seems that might be a simple fix to make sure this kind of confusion is not generated by the system?
As the IT manager testified, yes, there could be a fix to it, but unfortunately, there is a contest between operational needs, essentially what the goal of NJ Spirit is, and the fact that the investigation could reflect an inaccurate address. So in other words, the goal of the Spirit system is to keep the addresses and keep any time somebody launches any document from the investigation is to give the reader the most accurate information.
I understand, but it seems to me that, I don't want to belabor it, but it seems to me that information could be presented with, on this date we had this address, and on that date we have this address, have the cumulative information, and not have any kind of misleading printout of a snapshot that really is not a snapshot. Do you see what I'm saying?
No, I do understand. And as of the time of the remand hearing, they were considering that change. I don't know if they have implemented that. I think there are some, what I was saying is I think there are some operational concerns with that as far as whether it will damage the integrity of what the system was designed to do. But they can certainly do that. And then the more simple fix, frankly, is to, instead of reprinting investigations, these investigations are printed and put in the file. At the remand, the caseworker was able to go back right into the file and pull the original investigation. So the simplest fix here is simply not to reprint the investigations, but instead, in discovery, provide the old investigation, which will not have misleading information.
Thank you.
Does the agency feel that it would be overly burdensome if we were to agree with an argument that says each time a proceeding or a new action is being commenced by the division, a new investigation should be conducted by the division to search for individuals?
A new search?
Yes.
No, that is the division's policy, and I think the caseworker testified to that. Whenever there is That's entirely reasonable. That's under the statute, and that is absolutely something the division agrees with, and that goes back to Justice Radner's question of whether this is a systemic concern or a concern unique to this case.
Well, but in this instance, the adoption worker opened it up and saw a reasonably close in time affidavit right there and did not conduct a fresh search. So what I'm suggesting is a systemic correction, which would, notwithstanding that recent filing, require a new search at the commencement of the guardianship.
The division would be entirely in agreement with that. That is the general. That is the policy. That's the statute, frankly, and that is what the division should be doing in all cases. Again, what happened here, unfortunately, as the worker indicated, she overlooked that. She did testify that was her goal. That was her typical routine in conducting a new guardianship case. It just did not happen in this one, but the division would certainly not be in disagreement with that whatsoever.
Other questions, anyone? Yeah. Anything you'd like to add?
Just that, in response finally to Justice Patterson's question, there is no question that the division had the responsibility to search for EMC. But DMH tells us that we also have to look at the parents' actions in responding to the division's efforts and taking steps to care for his child. The entirety of the record here, from the time that AEC was born in 2009, all the way through the conclusion of the guardianship trial in June of 2016, reflects that EMC was given adequate time to step forward, adequate efforts, and that he failed to do so. For all those reasons, I would ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Gregory. Mr. Ballantyne.
This case is ultimately about the health and safety of AEC, my client, who's now 9 years old, lives with his siblings, siblings that he's grown up with in this home for at least 4 years, not his siblings on his father's side, who I don't know that he has seen, but he obviously knows who they are. And he's thriving there in this placement. EMC carefully avoids the topic of the bond between my client and his caregiver and these siblings, which Your Honors have pointedly raised, which have been forged over this period of time while EMC was essentially in hiding. Although a father's focus should be on what's best for his child, EMC focuses on the failures of a case manager to hunt him down, and he uses this as a sword and as a shield in this case. And whether or not he was served in the Title IX litigation, which he did not appeal, whether there was human error in applying the division's operating procedures, which admittedly there was, information that a case manager put in an affidavit but failed to testify to, and that that EMC did not know how to contact a huge state agency, DCPP. These are all smoke screens. EMC even went so far as to force all of us to litigate his claim that he lived at 49 Schuyler Terrace, an issue that took 6 months to settle in motion practice and a remand plenary hearing when EMC knew all along that he did not live at 49 Schuyler Terrace in 2012. This stalling tactic may have benefited him, but it was to the detriment of my client, AEC, and to my client's permanency. Now, EMC asks this court to believe all of his unsupported factual allegations, or defenses, I'm sorry, which is that he was employed at the time, that's why he couldn't make the psychological evaluation. He had another child that went to the hospital, that he had transportation issues. None of these are factually supported, but he asked this court to use that as to why he did not attend his evaluations. He didn't testify, he didn't show up to his trial, and he throws, frankly, I would say to the court, he throws candor out the window. What defense has not mentioned is that the division's address searches and the affidavit would have included, and did include, I'm sorry, all relevant state and federal agencies, which would have included the probation department, child support. None of those folks knew where he was. He was off the grid, this father, for all intents and purposes. Obviously, the post office didn't know where he was, so where he lived was not in his name.
What period of time are you referring to?
So this is after they lost track of him and when the first affidavit was submitted, when they did that first search. The affidavit includes I mean, voluminous numbers of agencies that were contacted to find his address, and nothing turned up. Admittedly, they should have searched for his mother. That might have been a good avenue to find him, perhaps. Although they did, as mentioned, they did go to the home, and nobody there seemed to know anything about him or where he was located. But so what's the most important issue here? It's whether it's in the best interest of my client, AEC, for this court to extend his need for permanency in order to address EMC's grievances that the division failed to do everything to locate him while he hid from them, essentially. And this is the context in which I ask the court, we must remind ourselves that when we consider every issue in this case, what is in AEC's best interests. The message I ask this court to send is this: a vulnerable child will not be punished for the incomplete casework of a few agency professionals, especially when the appellant parent has made no efforts to involve themselves in his child's life. A child's need for permanency and the legal policy to provide it expeditiously really can only yield to a parent who is making diligent efforts to be reunited with a child and perhaps needs more time to make to effectuate those efforts. And that's the case of CS as well as DMH, as the Attorney General has mentioned. Courts must consider the division's efforts and supports on an individualized basis, which is what we ask the court to do today. And whether or not they're reasonable includes whether the parents are actively involved in the reunification effort. DMC's subnominal efforts, or almost no efforts, and attachment are important factors in this regard. The innocent party here is my client, who's bonded with an excellent caregiver with his siblings and really doesn't know his father in the least. I submit that the division's efforts were reasonable. They were not perfect. They were imperfect. But this does not demand a remand and more time for my client to languish without permanency.
Can you tell us what the effect of removing AEC from his situation right now would be?
As Dr. Singer indicated, it would be pretty devastating to this child, emotionally, developmentally, educationally, everything. And he would, I'm supposing you're asking that he would go back to his father, what would be the the implications? My perspective is this is a very imperfect father. It's been said that he's raising six children, but the fact is that the division was involved with that other family of his for a year, just trying to get those children enrolled in school. I think it took several months for him to do so. And prior facts in this case indicate that this father did not hold my client's best interests at heart. So I think it would be quite devastating.
One other question for you. And what is the purpose of a psychological evaluation? Is it beyond just mental capacity?
It is. In this case, it would have been trying to get to the root of why this father essentially abandoned this child, back to a situation with his mother that was very neglectful. We really have in these cases two choices. One, it's a case manager to make a determination as to what services a parent needs. And we don't want the case managers making all of those decisions.
We want to have mental health professionals. I'm sorry. Do they flow out of the psychological evaluation?
And that would come from the psychological evaluation. They go much beyond just diagnosing a parent per the DSM.
Great.
So I will wrap up. Just regarding the psychological evaluation, as stated, Judge Guadagno reviewed the facts de novo and came to very different conclusions in the trial court. The house fire, the lack of transportation, another hospitalized child, employment. These were facts which were not in evidence. The father was asked to supply information to support his defenses, and he provided none. Although Judge Guadagno took those as fact, as defense is now proposing to the court at this point. But those were not facts in evidence.
What were the basis for those? Were those assertions that were presented and not supported?
Right. Yeah.
Assertions by counsel?
By counsel.
Anything you'd like to add?
Yes, I would like to wrap up real fast. Let's see. I think I've stated, I'll leave a lot of this out, it's in my briefs, but just, I ask the court not to punish my client for the failures of an imperfect division. The case managers in these cases, I often would fight them in trial court, but the truth is that they're very overworked. They have a lot to do. Everything that they have to submit to try to get one service requires many forms. They transport children to evaluations. They deal with parents. Things do fall through the cracks sometimes, and that's what happened in this case. But my client, who's doing very well and thriving, should not be forced to wait any longer to achieve permanency.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Licata, rebuttal?
Thank you. I just wanted to address DMH briefly.
I'm sorry.
I wanted to address the case of DMH. After this court's decision, obviously DMH has been interpreted many times by the appellate division and other decisions, but one appellate division decision in FH noted that this court's decision in DMH must be understood, considered, and applied in the context of a clear record showing a pattern of parental inaction and neglect amounting to unfitness. And respectfully, that did not happen here. We had a parent who had successfully cared for his child, who visited, although maybe not as often as we would have liked when the child left his mother, who consistently reaffirmed during the guardianship litigation that he wanted his son. As to housing, again, trial counsel requested a security deposit to assist EMC in getting housing after the fire and provided proof of employment. Note that assistance was not forthcoming. And as I said before, there was no attempt by the worker to intercede with the Section 8 worker on the morning of June 10th to schedule a more convenient time for an employment, an appointment. Had the one service arguably that EMC really did positively need was stable housing. And that is what caused trial counsel at the end of the guardianship trial to say, he wants to maintain the parental relationship, but he can't take custody right now. He, at that point, still did not have stable housing. That does not mean that termination of parental rights is justified. I would like to address the statement that he refused to provide his address. None of the paper documents in this case, filed by the contact sheet from Ms. Benjamin or her affidavit, indicate that she even asked for the address. And her testimony on the remand hearing after the fact was that she asked for the address, and when asked what the response was, it was evasive. He stood mute. He didn't provide an answer. I don't remember his body language. It was so long ago. So we don't have a situation where his address was asked for, either during the June 2014 encounter or afterwards. Just briefly to address Justice Patterson's question about the addresses, the way the address appears, the IT manager did address that briefly in testimony, saying that addresses could be maintained in the records by when a new address is entered, adding as of an effective date. And that would, when the data fills in the document template, that would add an additional line with the addresses. The old address would show up as well as the most current. That wasn't done here, obviously. And again, to emphasize that all of the workers here, they all testified they did not search New Jersey Spirit, nor was it their practice to do so, each pointing the finger at the other. Concerning the grandmother, EMC's mother and sister, the investigation reports from both investigations in relation to this case and the other case provide contact information for those people. A phone number for the sister is provided in one report. Her employer is noted in the other report. The same with the grandmother. No attempt was made to contact those relatives.
I have two really quick questions. At some point in January, he did get a copy of the complaint. It was handed to him. Does the copy of the complaint specifically say what he's facing? Does it tell him that he... it's about custody, it's about a permanency plan, it's about what his rights are on the face sheet of it? Does it say all that?
I would have to look at this complaint again.
Don't they generally?
Typically a complaint reprints everything that's in Spirit. So, right,
so
it's
but
just
it's got a notice on the front of it, does it not, as to what his rights are briefly? And it has some content about what he's facing. I mean, to sit here and say he didn't know at any point, certainly the day the trial was scheduled, what he was facing, seems a bit absurd to me.
I'm sorry, Justice Solomon. Our contention is not that he didn't know at trial what he
I'll
was
tell you
facing.
Why I asked that.
I'm sorry?
He knows that, okay, so you're not really disputing that by the time the case is scheduled, got
right.
postponed once because he could make the psych on the 8th, and then on the 10th, they're going to start. He knows what he's facing.
Yes, at that point.
Okay,
my statements related to the period
before.
I got you.
On that day, he's told, all right, go for the psych. Why, I can't. I have a conflict an hour and a half later. And they don't reschedule it. We're going to trial. You go to that appointment. He doesn't even show up. He knows what he's facing. He knows what he's being told to do by the court. He doesn't even show up at 9 o'clock in the morning and say, listen, I'm here, but I got to be out here by 10:30. Or as far as we know, there's nothing in the record to indicate he even tried to postpone the 10:30 appointment. He just doesn't show up like he did for all the other times that he tried to reschedule or said he didn't show up and then came up with an excuse afterwards for both visitation and evaluation. There's something missing here. I mean, it doesn't paint a very good picture of the parent while the child is languishing in limbo for years.
Well, as far as Justice Solomon, as far as the morning of the trial is concerned, he basically was faced with a Hobson's choice.
No, he wasn't.
But
no, he wasn't.
We don't.
9 o'clock in the morning, he's got a psych evaluation. He's risking his child. He doesn't even show up. He doesn't go there and say, listen, I got to be out here at 10:30. He doesn't do anything, which is consistent with what happened with all the other appointments for court and evals they didn't show up for. What do we read into that? I mean, that's part of the record.
As far as the prior appointments that he didn't show up for, we do know from the record that he wasn't there because he was in conflict.
He says, I had conflicts after the fact, after he didn't show up. He had an excuse that there's no evidence was, in fact, a real excuse.
What were those conflicts?
Well, of course, there was the house fire, obviously. Then there was the hospitalization of the child.
And as you respond, can you tell us what's in the record as evidence, as distinct from arguments of counsel?
As far as the house fire was concerned, that was verified by the division through the Red Cross, and that was known. As far as the hospitalization of the other child, the court did ask him to bring in documentation, and that was not provided, but counsel on his behalf explained that he tried to find the records and they were misplaced. He could not find them.
They were misplaced at the hospital?
It's unclear where they were misplaced. We do know he was living with relatives.
Perhaps at his house, but counsel wasn't aware that you could get copies from the hospital?
I believe counsel was aware of that. And
they weren't produced anyway, correct?
Correct.
Was there at least an affidavit?
Counsel wasn't even told what hospital it was.
That may be so. I don't recall.
Was there an affidavit filed by your client?
On that issue?
On all of the issues, other than representations by the attorney as to why he wasn't able to appear?
There was no affidavit filed. But I will say that in other cases, representations of counsel on issues like this have been accepted and deemed sufficient and not required to be proven by documentary evidence.
What was the excuse for his not appearing at the trial?
On June 10th, the excuse was that he had the appointment with the Section 8 Housing Administrator. And granted, one is at 9 o'clock and one is at 10:30. But we don't know how far apart the two appointments were, whether he had transportation, if he had come to...
We don't know. Why don't we know? Isn't your client at least responsible for the lack of the record? He's fighting for his child. No affidavit, nothing that would be considered admissible in court as to why he was unable to appear at the trial at which his parental rights were to be terminated.
Trial proceeded without him on that day. And again, we don't know how long he was at the appointment, whether he was able to make it to the court while trial was still in session.
Even afterwards, he could have made a motion to vacate the judgment by filing papers. Did he do that?
He did not.
Anything else you'd like to add?
May I have 1 second?
Sure.
I have nothing further.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under